Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Look, there are a lot of NPR podcasts out there, and a lot of them are ones that we think you might enjoy. For word games and puzzles and trivia of all sorts, you should check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour. It blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Do you like Jonathan Colton? Who doesn't like Jonathan Colton? He's on that show. Ophira Eisenberg on that show. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we will take a quick trip to the glitz and glamour that is the Oscars. Then we'll look at a show that has just begun its sixth season that we have never visited with before, also shiny and sparkly, RuPaul's Drag Race. Then we'll talk about what you can do with yourself when you are trapped inside the house with nowhere to go. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I poke around in the vicinity of movies, theater, and other kinds of pop culture.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, due to some snow issues on Monday, we are taping on Tuesday, so we've all had at least over 24 hours to recover from the excitement of the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, I actually find they've aged in my memory like a fine wine.
Yeah, well, and having had some time to reflect, I always like to go to our glittering spectacle expert, Glenn Weldon, to open a conversation like this. Glenn, how did the Oscars strike you?
Genial. You know, this is what Ellen DeGeneres, this word has attached to Ellen DeGeneres over the years, like a lamprey attaches to whatever a lamprey attaches to.
Yeah.
And she was perfectly fine. The Oscars themselves seemed a little musty to me, or fusty in kind of an old-fashioned, in a very specific old-fashioned kind of way. I mean, when you get a joke about Liza Minnelli that has actually been told since 1983, you combine that with...
And she doesn't think it's any funnier now.
No.
Right.
You combine that with a Bette Midler singing the wind beneath my wings, combined with a salute to Judy Garland. It's the year 2014.
Uh-huh.
It's like they're zeroing in on that target demographic with laser-like precision of 68-year-old gay dudes.
Yeah.
It's like, ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Joan Crawford and the Wirehanger Dancers. It's very odd. It's sort of blended. I mean, I like the fact that there were no dance numbers.
Yeah.
The musical numbers seemed to make sense because those were the songs. That's what it should work.
Yeah.
There were some celebrations of the movies.
Yeah,
Steven.
Several of the ones Steven really liked.
My Twitter feed, I was barely tweeting because I was wrapping up a project, but like all of a sudden my at replies started exploding every time they would do a salute to the movies. Uh-huh. And
How about you, Trey? How do they strike you?
Well, technically, I didn't find the Judy Garland thing quite so off because it was the 75th anniversary of the movie, right? That they were actually sort of saluting the movie.
Yeah, but it's the 75th anniversary of many movies every year.
That is true. I thought it was sluggish, and I thought Ellen was kind of flat. I have to say, I was not a particular fan of her hosting job.
Yeah.
The jokes seemed really tame.
And yet mean, I was going to say, they were tame in
such a way that the meanness really poked through.
It's a matter of the fact she came out, and the first stuff she did was like, June Squibb is old.
At 84 years old, she is the oldest nominee. She was wonderful in Nebraska. I'm telling everyone that you are wonderful in Nebraska.
And then she went to the Liza Minnelli thing.
And I have to say, one of the most amazing Liza Minnelli impersonators I have ever seen in my entire life. Just really, seriously. Good job, sir. I mean, that is really...
I'm not saying I'm offended. I'm just saying it seemed like she came out and it was kind of a rat-tat-tat of things that were like, and not that funny.
Just a little tonally off.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where if they had been funnier, it would have been fine. I just didn't think the jokes were that good.
I still feel like Ellen is deserving of, like, an Emmy Award for outstanding achievement in the field of not being Seth MacFarlane.
Sure.
And I've heard a couple people note, and I think it's true. I mean, it wasn't awesome, but I think her strategy of being down there in the audience, among the people in the audience, which is kind of what she does on her show,
right,
made a lot of sense. I think that did make some sense, and I think it worked okay.
I definitely think the most surreal moment was John Travolta's introduction of Idina Menzel, which, you know, there have been people who've said since then, I don't know the truth of this, but they've said he is dyslexic and have said maybe that's what happened.
I also think that any moment, when you think about, I mean, we sit here every week and do this podcast and we misspeak all the time.
No, of course, it's the question is if you know that it's not going to be taken out, would you not have at some point heard the name of the person? I mean, to me,
I'm John Travolta, and you are
Adele Mazzini. I think it's much more of a just kind of a funny thing that happened than it is a terrible thing he did. It's nothing like that. It is funny when it happens because your whole Twitter feed in unison goes, "What did you say?" But what I said to somebody yesterday is it was the weighted average of every other Oscar telecast. It just, to me, was right in the middle. Yeah. It wasn't particularly enjoyable. It wasn't particularly terrible. It was certainly better than the last two.
I mean, Ellen has this kind of knockabout charm that I find appealing and certainly largely harmless.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
But it created some weird momentum swings that often happen on the Oscars where the show is kind of droning along for 3 hours and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, quick, picture, actor, actress, director.
Right,
like,
absolutely.
The last 25 minutes, they gave out all the big awards.
But am I right in thinking they didn't play anybody off at all?
I don't think they did.
A much better job.
I don't think they
did
at all. They certainly didn't play anybody off with Jaws, which is what they did last year. Boy. Anyway, we all, on the Oscars omnibus, we all picked 12 Years a Slave as Best Picture, and it won. Mm-hmm. You know, you had definitely some winners that I was very much in favor of. You know, I was fine with several of those performances. We got to hear Matthew McConaughey explain a lot about his philosophy of life, right. I guess.
Yeah.
So you see, every day, every week, every month, and every year of my life, my hero's always 10 years away. I'm never going to be my hero. I'm not going to attain that. I know I'm not. And that's just fine with me because that keeps me with somebody to keep on chasing. So to any of us, whatever those things are, whatever it is we look up to, whatever it is we look forward to, and whoever it is we're chasing, to that I say amen. To that I say all right, all right, all right. And that I say just keep living, huh? Thank you.
I think it goes without saying, too, that that Lupita Nyong'o pretty much won the entire awards season.
When I look down at this golden statue, may it remind me and every little child that no matter where you're from, your dreams are valid. Thank you.
Just utterly charming.
Just
gracious.
Perfection.
Great speech. Danced with Pharrell Williams.
Right?
I mean... Yeah. At any rate, I think that's about as much Oscars as we probably have the stomach for, but you should feel free to come and find us and tell us what you thought. Our main, what we would normally call our A this week, is a little show that we have never talked about, even though we have talked about talking about it. We've had people ask us to talk about it, and we've never gotten around to it.
Is that right?
I believe it's made Glenn happy in the past, but we've never done a full segment.
We've never done a segment, and that is RuPaul's Drag Race. Now, Glenn Weldon, advocate of this segment, give me the elevator pitch for this show.
This show, not to oversell it, is a force for good in the world. it's 14 drag queens who are competing to be the next big drag queen superstar.
Is that a thing? Like, can you become that?
I'm sure it increases the fees that
it's a top show.
I'm not saying you can't. I'm genuinely asking.
It certainly helps the performing careers.
Right.
Right. And I think some of them have found that to be the case. Some of the ones who've been on in the past, I've seen them pop up.
And they also go on tour. It's a whole thing.
And they get a lot of exposure from this show.
Yep, great.
So this show is overproduced like every reality show is overproduced, but it shows you how it's overproducing things. Mm-hmm. It shows you how it's shaping arcs. What I really admire about the show is intelligence. So we don't see RuPaul in full drag until the very end. We see him throughout, but we only catch him at the end. It's an event he makes. Go figure. He makes an entrance.
Yeah, that's true.
With CoverGirl playing.
And he has a work ethic. RuPaul does. It's spelled W-E-R-K, but it's still a work ethic. He wants you to do the job. He wants you to put in the effort.
Yeah.
And what we didn't see in this initial set of episodes is many of them come, not certainly not all of them, but many of them come from they've dealt with a lot in their lives.
Right, right.
They have overcome a lot. They've dealt with rejection from parents and things like that in many cases. And there is a lot of heart. You didn't really necessarily see it in these two episodes, but it's coming.
I went back and watched some from last season to try to get a better feel for it. And I will say, before we do the rest of this, I just want to say, I did my research because my big question about doing this segment was, using correct pronouns, right? Because this, of course, is something that people talk about a lot. And it is one of those things where people who are really well-intentioned and think that they're smart can put their foot massively in their mouth.
Yeah, sure.
And it's really upsetting and hurtful to people. So I was doing my research. And what I discovered was, helpfully enough, it depends on the person.
Yep.
Because I looked at the GLAAD Media Guide, and I looked at the National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association Guide, which Trey is part of that organization. I looked at all these media guides and did some other research. Basically, what it said is they generally prefer to be referred to as she when they're performing.
Right.
When they're not performing, many prefer he because they don't consider themselves trans. Some of them are trans. Some of them aren't trans, but still like she the rest of the time. So what I personally am doing is what seemed to be the weighted average of what they generally think, which is if you cannot ask the person what they prefer, which we can't, you do the when performing, it's she, and when not, it's he. But well, I just want people to know we are trying.
And on the show, there are several of them who speak of their character as a sort of third person.
In the third person. That's fascinating to me, too.
And use the feminine pronoun, too.
Yeah.
As a guy who thinks a little bit too much, an inordinate amount, about the concept of superheroes and why they're important and what they say, what they do for us as a culture, you know, I'm not the first person to make this connection, but this is exactly what's going on here.
Yeah.
They are
creating
an alternate persona. They are putting a costume on that literally empowers them, that actually gives them something like agency.
And you get that weird thing that you and I have talked about with Clark Kent and Superman, whereas which is the real person and which is the is kind of the performance. It is a completely fascinating comparison to me. And incidentally, with RuPaul in particular, has said, I don't care. Either is fine in whatever whatever stage of my life I'm at. You know, it's all been very interesting.
There is, you know, the term that gets thrown around by these queens a lot is glamour. It's not glamour in the magazine sense. It's the sense of this giant illusion. You can see it happen. Sooner or later, they're going to do a challenge where each queen must take usually a straight guy, dress him up in drag to be part of his drag family, drag house, so that they must seem similar. They must seem related.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the difference between a drag queen and a dude in a dress. And you can actually see it happen when they get a really bad critique. You see it change on stage. They have this confidence, and then something happens,
it punctures
and it's a dude in makeup. It's about the set of the shoulders. It's fascinating.
Whereas I saw one of the ones I watched from last season was one where they did makeovers of gay veterans.
Yeah.
It was, for like a billion reasons, it was the absolute most fascinating thing. And you talk about this pronoun stuff. Some of them, the guy walked in the door and they were calling him he. They started to put the makeup on and they started calling them she, but not everyone and not all the time. And when they would get mad at them, they would go back and forth. That one was completely awesome. And if you're kind of wondering about the heart aspect, that's a very good episode to kind of get a feel for where the emotion is fairly genuine.
Yeah. So this show has been off my radar for a little while, and I came back to it. I'm still not sure. I watched the first two episodes of this season. I'm already getting a little tired of the writing, the constant punning that goes on, especially when the judges give them feedback.
Yeah.
Your runway look was a little Downton shabby. I'm sorry, but you're up for elimination. Adore Delano. Your couture was a honey of a boo-boo. Vivacious. Your runway strut was pure Vogue. But your outfit was vague.
Yeah, it feels like they have writers.
Oh,
sure.
Definitely,
I mean, which, of course,
writers.
They do.
Somebody's in a costume inspired by St. Patrick's Day. Wow, look at those lucky charms.
Right.
And I'm like, it's just so labored.
There is a tone to this. You mentioned it earlier. There is a specific thing you have to do. You have to do the double entendre, because if you do the single entendre, it's like you get Match Game wrong. Remember Match Game? When if somebody says the actual joke, that's not it. That's not what this is about.
Right.
Everything is in quotation marks. It's camp. Everything that we do on this show is in quotation marks. So you really have to finesse it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, if they're not smart, don't have that gift.
Yeah.
Part of my enjoyment of the show, and this show has taken a little while for me to fully get on board with it. It's pitched differently than all of the other elimination-based reality shows I watch.
Yeah.
All of the elimination-based reality shows I watch have a little bit of a quieter, steadier rhythm to them, just a lower volume.
Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously by design. It is a very, very loud show.
Mm-hmm.
Most shows have some loud people and some quiet people.
people.
Right, this is this the show is, where everyone
this
is that one person.
Who will be named Queen Loud?
It's true.
And so that took me a little while to get fully on board with it. And there are certainly elements of shows that you've already seen. There's a huge Project Runway element, particularly in the sort of fashion challenge early on. There's also a ton of America's Next Top Model.
Two queens stand before me. Ladies, this is your last chance to impress me and save yourself from elimination. The time has come. Reach lip sync for your life.
I want RuPaul to host America's Next Top Model.
Yeah.
Just because it would be like a sane Tyra Banks.
And it would be taking it the right amount of seriously.
Which is to say not like this is a life and I mean, they still establish some stakes. This is still important. It's still
$100,000.
It's still $100,000. It's still a chance to make more money for performing, which I like the fact that they'll occasionally just come out and say, I'm doing this because then when I perform, it won't be for $50.
Right.
But I found myself really getting on board with it as it rolled along. Once my brain adjusted to just having like all of the colors and all of the sounds thrown at me, I'm very accustomed to paying attention to reality TV with roughly 49% of my attention span, give or take 2%. This requires like 97% of your
attention. And I get the feeling that you're kind of reaching for how to explain what it is about these personalities that's a little bit hard to take in volume for me. This is not about the fact that they're drag queens. This is about the fact that they're theater people.
Yeah.
If you made a reality show that was two different branches of improv everywhere and you watched them for an hour at a time, I would want to rip my own eyeballs out and tear my ears off.
Well,
this
is a show you watch
anyway.
While you're drinking, never when you're hungover.
I think that's killer advice. I agree completely with Glenn's take. I think it's very charming. I enjoy it a lot. As I said, we originally agreed that we would try to watch at least the first two, and then I wound up going back and watching a bunch of ones from last season, and I really am enjoying it a lot. It's not a show I had ever gotten into, even though I had a bunch of friends who were into it. Yep. But I'm really glad I did, and I really like it, but...
No,
there is part of me that wouldn't want to marathon it the way I do, like Survivor or America. And it's not because it's drag queens; it's because it's theater people.
No, I
love theater people. I have a lot of that in me myself, but that's a lot of people who have to be the loudest person in the room.
it's not only
the
that.
Shiniest and the funniest. Mm-hmm. And the...
Yeah, well, and also in many cases doing their act.
Yeah, yes.
Right.
You
exactly.
Know, part of it is in the first couple episodes you're still meeting these people, so it's very important that they do their act.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there is a certain like, you can't ask them to dial it down.
No, but
it's also because it's on Logo. There's also some unbelievably salty language on this show. Just as fair warning, I started out, because I didn't watch it as it was airing, I bought it on iTunes. I bought the first episode on iTunes.
Oh, yeah, you get all the dirty words if you
buy it.
Oh,
is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I watched it on Amazon, had the same experience.
And so I downloaded, first it was like episode 6.0, and it was like a half an hour sizzle reel of just meeting, it's Meet the Queens. It's like 35 minutes long, and it's all bleeped. And all of a sudden, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch the first episode. And all of a sudden, like, C-bombs are flying.
Yes.
And I do not get that from reality television.
And I got to say, if you like this show, as Donna from Parks and Recreation would say, treat yourself to one or two episodes that you purchase from an online outlet that will allow you to hear all of the... I mean, he doesn't actually say, don't bleep it up.
Right.
You know?
Right.
One of the things that I thought was sort of, I don't know if I want to call it poignant. There's a guy on this show. There is a queen on this show. And before she was a drag queen, he was on American Idol.
Yes. When he was 17,
his name was, at that point, his performing name and his real name was Danny Noriega. And now he performs as Adore Delano.
Which isn't that different from an American Idol performance.
No.
Right?
No. And it was fascinating to me to watch her perform and realize, like, oh, this is probably much closer to this kid's actual self,
even though
it seems so stagey and much more kind of conventionally performative for her. when she's performing, that's a much more authentic self, probably, than what managed to come out of American Idol when they got cranked through the thing, which people don't as much look at and think there's, I mean, it's its own kind of drag. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like once you've been through that mushifier to come out the other end of the extruder the way they want an American Idol contestant to be, it's its own kind of
drag. You've been styled and coached.
Yeah.
And, well, and Adore has this great line where she describes her Danny Noriega persona as looking like a lesbian Jonas brother, which is so true.
Yeah.
It's true. It really is true. And it was really interesting when you're having all these thoughts about this show and how on everybody seems to be all the time, and how that's one of the things that makes it something I probably wouldn't stream episode after episode after episode is that everybody's on all the time. And then you realize, but everybody on American Idol's on all the time. It's just a more socially acceptable way of being on all the time. It's just an easier way to go through the world being on in that way as opposed to on in this way.
You're going to find that they divide themselves up, but not according to personality. Nothing so boring as personality, but into kind of drags.
Right.
Yeah. So there's the ones who have their guiding star is Beyonce. You know, they tend to be the younger ones. Mm-hmm. The older ones kind of go into a more classic campy film kind of thing.
And,
you know,
where,
but they're still referring to cha-cha heels, which is a reference from 1971's Female Trouble, which is like, really?
There is a ton of age politics that floats around in here. Little age among drag queens is clearly
how much the culture has changed as you're coming of age as a 40-year-old drag queen versus as a 22-year-old.
Well, it's also true that age is much more explosive for women than it is for men in general. So if you're performing in drag, all of a sudden you're in male standards of beauty some of the time, maybe. You're certainly in female standards of beauty some of the time, and you're in this whole other third drag standards of beauty, which are different.
Thing.
Which are
and
clearly
there is,
different.
There is, my understanding, and I have never done drag except for one really unfortunate Halloween.
Picture. But
I
know.
I was going to say we have a Facebook.
There's
page.
A picture. There's a picture out there somewhere, but I damn sure I'm not ever putting it up.
I don't know. You put up the curly perm.
It's true. I put up the curly perm. I know a lot of drag queens, though. There is a kind of motherliness that comes with being a senior drag queen, and you get some respect for being a senior drag queen in a lot of places.
Absolutely, it's fascinating to me. I like the show. I'm glad we did this.
I tried watching when Glenn recommended it initially, and I just felt like I was being yelled at.
And you were.
I was. And I just stepped away from it, and lo and behold, it's season 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now I'm watching this show.
Yeah. It was really, it's
this
fun.
Started as the little show that could. It had zero budget and incredible.
Still kind of looks like it has
incredibly
zero
cheesy production values. Yeah,
most of its budget now is for feathers.
I love the kind of variety of judges that they get. I love the fact that there was one episode where they had Clinton Kelly from What Not to Wear, which is a really kind of super mainstream square kind of fashion show. And I loved the fact that he was on the show, and they had Adam Lambert,
Neil Patrick Harris has been a judge. It's Santino Rice.
Rice has found his true calling, I think. Yes. But at any rate, again, I'm really glad we did that show. And again, come back and tell us what you thought, because I'm fascinated. I have a feeling this is one that a lot of people are going to be glad that we finally bit into. At any rate, I was speaking the other day. This is takes us into what we would call our B topic. I was speaking the other day to our friend Barry Hardiman, who is, by the time you hear this, there's a very good chance she will already have had her new baby. If not, she is, anxiously awaiting her new baby. And we mark all of Barry's child-related milestones with special shows, segments. So what she said to me, and she was kidding, but of course, you know, when you kid with me, you never know. She said, feel free to do another segment where you talk about kind of what you can do when you got to sit around a lot. Because, of course, you got a new baby, you got to sit around a lot. So we thought that we would do just a couple quick rounds of recommendations of what to do with yourself when you're kind of stuck in the house. Or you're stuck on the couch, or you're stuck nursing, let's say, or something. So we're going to do a couple rounds. Glenn Weldon, do you have a recommendation?
I do. We haven't talked about books in a while, so I have a series of books that you descend into. This is exactly the series of books you want to spend a lot of time in. This is the Gormenghast Trilogy by Mervyn Peake, starting with Titus Groan, which was published in 1946, wow. Gormenghast, published in 1950, and Titus Alone, the weirdest one, and the one if you wanted to skip one, published in 1959. Collectively, about 3,000 pages, I think. This is set in a giant city-state that is dominated by an enormous castle in which the Groans, a royal family, an earldom, actually, have been in power since time immemorial. This castle is labyrinthine, and everything in it is moldering. They're observing ritual blindly because it has been done forever. It's all about the hierarchies. So if I read you a little bit of this language, which is gorgeous and rich, you'll get a sense of what I'm talking about here. The author is describing one of the towers in the castle. It's called the Tower of Flints. Blackened with ivy, it rose like a mutilated finger from among the fists of knuckled masonry and pointed blasphemously to heaven. At night, the owls made of it an echoing throat. By day, it stood voiceless and cast its long shadow. Ooh, I just love that.
You need to do some audiobook performances.
So you get a sense of what it is, right? It's a little castle of Otranto. It's a little cask of Amontillado. It's a little Downton Abbey if they cast Lady Elizabeth out and she became a feral wild woman of the forest who attacked the local townsfolk. Which, by the way, Julian Fellowes, season 5, maybe.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Lady Elizabeth.
It's got incredible Dickensian names like Sepulcrave and Dr. Prune Squalor and Sourdust and Flay and Nancy Slag and Opus Fluke and Steerpipe and Fuchsia and Perch Prism Shrivel. So it's called fantasy, even though nothing really supernatural happens in it. It's just this sprawling, huge, incredibly rich sense of place that you get. As I say, nothing supernatural happens in it, but you do get the definite sense of, like, Poe, this incredible sense of foreboding. It's all very gloomy, but it's very funny. It's fantastic, and this is the kind of series of books you just want to sort of sink into by a window when it rains.
Very nice. Trey Graham, how about a recommendation?
I don't have a specific artifact to recommend. I have an activity. I have finally gotten on the Throwback Thursday bandwagon. This is the thing on Facebook where you find an old photo of yourself, usually an awkward one. Mm-hmm. This is part of the thing. I've finally gotten over myself enough to indulge in the self-mockery of posting a ridiculous photo of myself mm-hmm. every week on Facebook. And I've discovered that I really enjoy sifting through old pictures. Mm. I've reached that stage in my life. So I'm going to go organize that bin of old photos that never got put into an album.
Stephen, do you have a recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, somewhat on a similar note to what Trey was saying, I think that anytime you are cooped up, anytime you are in somewhat forced isolation, I love the idea, like Trey was saying, of sorting through photos. I was saying something similar about, like, your Netflix queue, that going in and, like, if when you are stranded, you cannot either watch whatever is in your Netflix queue or delete whatever is in your Netflix
right.
queue. You know, being isolated gives you a sense of what you will never watch.
That's true. Because then you're like, if I'm not going to do it now, I really don't want to watch it.
Because I do a lot. I've often complained, and I think I get this from my mother, that I sometimes spend more time accumulating entertainment than I spend consuming it.
Yeah.
And that I spend more time, like, making sure I have all of this. And then they sit in, the DVDs will sit with the shrink wrap still on them for, you know, for years and years and years. And I think that deciding what to give up on is a great project.
That is a great project.
And on a similar note, if you are in the Barry situation, and particularly if it is your first child, this is a great time to watch things like The Wire or RuPaul's Drag Race Uncensored, things that you will one day not be able to watch around those children.
Fantastic. True. Wonderful. Well, first thing I wanted to recommend is I'm looking for the future to bring back magazines, which seem to me to have sort of, they fell into a little bit of a gap where buying print magazines went out a little bit and electronic versions of magazines have never really taken off. But if you have a tablet, as I do, there are some really fantastic tablet versions of magazines now. And if I can carry around, for example, the pile of old New Yorkers mm-hmm. is such a cultural trope that everybody talks about their pile of old New Yorkers. If I can keep my New Yorker on my tablet, as I do, then I will actually read it when I am in line, when I am sitting around, when I have 10 minutes. I will actually pick up and read something from The New Yorker. I subscribe to a whole bunch of magazines in tablet form, and it's because it's much easier for me when I don't have to deal with all the physical manifestations of them. Now, unfortunately, a lot of them, there's no other way to do it. They will still send you the print version because they need to print the ads. So I get them on my tablet. I read The New Yorker. I read Entertainment Weekly. I read Wired. I read New York Magazine. I read The Atlantic, basically all your long, wordy magazines, and then a couple
of long reads.
Well, I also read like Cooking Light and Glamour and some other things that are, you know, a little bit more frivolous. But a lot of magazines have gone really low in unsubscription rates just because they are in a little bit of trouble, which is kind of sad, but at the same time gives you an opportunity to rediscover them if you haven't. I mean, very frequently you can find subscriptions for sort of handful of dollars a year. So that's my suggestion.
I like it.
You have anything else, Glenn?
Yeah, another book. And I would recommend for both the Gormenghast trilogy and the book I'm about to recommend, get the real book, because these are both big honking tomes. And there's something about the tactile sensation of getting through something. It's an accomplishment. It's about knocking something down. It's about like taking it and using it as a trophy and mounting it as your wall. As I killed this thing.
Right.
I destroyed it.
That's how I felt when I read Nixon Land.
Yeah, exactly.
Vera, that's a big book.
So in 1993, the book A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth was the book that everybody pretended to have read. So
I still have a copy. Haven't opened it.
Exactly. Start with a book he wrote a little bit before that called Golden Gate, Vikram Seth's Golden Gate, which is a novel in sonnets. Hmm. So it's set in the 80s in San Francisco. It is a giant slab of a book that you can get through in a day. That's what I'm talking about, that sense of satisfaction. So you'll see yourself plowing through it, and it's really beautifully done. It should feel like a writing exercise, but it doesn't. It's a great story, it's very funny, and it's really gorgeous. So Vikram Seth's Golden Gate.
Fantastic. You have another one, Drew?
I do. To circle back to Stephen's idea of putting something together that will be useful to someone else, I in keeping with the idea that I sort of challenged myself with in New Year's resolutions about learning new things, I kind of want to try knitting.
Knitting. Yeah. Taking up knitting. Crafts are good.
You see these people sitting in coffee shops and socializing one-on-one, face-to-face, enjoying each other's company and knitting away and creating lovely things. And you get to like dive into this domain-specific nerdery about yarn compositions.
Sure.
And
yarn compositions.
And, you know, stitches. And
Trey, you are playing into the PCHH demographic.
And then you get to make, and then you get to also make your own
socks.
Hats and scarves, and scarves are very easy, I think.
I hear that's true.
You could probably start with some scarves.
Are you going to take up library science, too?
Yes, absolutely. Knitting while I study for my library science degree.
And watch some Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah. Stephen Thompson, how about you?
Well, and one of the nice things about something like knitting is that you can do it while catching up on whatever TV show.
On RuPaul Uncensored.
On RuPaul Uncensored. I think, in general, like part of the great benefit of being cooped up is that you can tackle all these things that seem like they're just too great investments. Like, I don't have 13 hours to watch House of Cards. And so if I, you know, I'm always thinking of House of Cards as a 13-hour block, right. It's really hard to dig through. And I think setting aside as many discrete 12-hour blocks as possible, not only your House of Cards and your Orange is the New Black, or in my case, like, oh, look, I grabbed off of YouTube an entire season of The Apprentice UK. look, I've got season 9. It's just waiting there. I haven't, you know, just whenever I suddenly break a leg, it's there. But one that I would throw out is, and Glenn talks about this a lot, is really sinking into a new video game. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I have really never done. For me, video games are like 5-10-minute investments. So I will slink into the Spectacular 5000 and play a couple games of Qbert. Or I will, you know, go in and, you know, like, look, I found a version of Galaga, and, you know, just play that. But to actually spend some time, and Linda, I know you've done this as well, like, take some time and absorb a medium that you've never thought of in the way that it's currently constructed.
I did it a while ago with Lego Marvel Superheroes.
Yeah, if there's a Lego game that feels like the Lego Movie.
There is. It's called the Lego Movie Game. And it basically is a much shorter version. You'll zip through it, but apparently it's more jokes.
And that's for like virtually every platform. And part of the idea of this is just try your hand at a new medium.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, try your hand, whether it's video games or comic books or knitting,
yep.
whatever it may be, this is one of the few opportunities that you really have to actually just make yourself a captive audience to something.
See it as an opportunity. My first candidate for my other suggestion was something that I discarded because what are the odds that everyone listening to this does not already know about this? And I tweeted about it a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. too, which is that the Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth version of Pride and Prejudice is on Amazon Prime. And I sat there recently and watched the whole thing. But that I discarded that. So that's not my real suggestion. Because mm-hmm. everyone listening to this already knows that, especially Barry. So the other one I picked, they are within the next little while here going to release the Veronica Mars movie, mm-hmm. which just about a year ago they were funding and we were talking about the funding and the Kickstarter campaign and everything. I have mixed feelings about the later seasons of Veronica Mars, the second and third. The first season of Veronica Mars is a, like the first season of Friday Night Lights, is a very fine document just as a set of episodes. And if you're looking for something to kind of sink into that's sort of timely, that will give you a good sense of why people care about this so much, that they went to all this trouble to bring this movie out and gave a lot of their own money, and why people are so unbelievably excited about this movie coming out, take yourself back, look at the first season. You don't have to commit to watching all three, but for a rainy day, Stephen was talking about 13-hour commitments. When you're talking about a network television show, you're really talking about 45-minute episodes. I think they did a full season, so it would take you a couple days to get through, even with long days. But you can get through that in a couple long days if you're laid up or have a hernia or a baby. So
there is not an equivalence.
So that's my other.
I've had a hernia, but not given birth.
So that's my other suggestion: is the first season of Veronica Mars. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, this is going to come as a surprise to nobody in this room because I have been feral for the last couple of months putting together the Austin 100, a 100-song playlist of artists performing at the South by Southwest Music Festival, which starts next weekend. This is the last episode of the show that will air before South by Southwest, so if you are going to be there, please do not be shy about saying hello. I love people. But if you have not yet done me a solid, gone to the NPR website and visited the Austin 100 page, you can stream it or in one click grab like an 839 megabyte zip file containing all of those songs that you can own. Please do so. It's like all I do this time of year.
I hear next year it's going to be the Austin 200.
Yes, what a good idea. Well, it entailed listening to like 1,500 different artists to pick out the 100 mm-hmm. Best. So it's like not only listen to a song, but judge it and then pick out the best ones. I'm very happy with it. There's a ton of great music in it. The likelihood that you will hear something you love that you have absolutely never heard before, I like to think is pretty high. So please, for the love of God, go to nprmusic.org and download the Austin 100. It's only up there for 30 days, and that clock started earlier this week, so hurry it up.
And will there be a Spotify list? Some questions about that.
Yes. If you go into the comments of the Austin 100, somebody has already helpfully pulled, I believe only about 70 of the 100 are on Spotify, but somebody has made a Spotify playlist already, bless their ever-loving heart.
Love the Austin 100. That's mm-hmm. where I first heard Kishibashi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. You. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
161 years ago, the New York Times published a story about Solomon Northup, the man at the center of 12 Years a Slave. This week, they corrected that story because they spelled his name two different ways. An author, the woman who wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, mm-hmm. caught the error while looking through the New York Times archive and tweeted about it. And the New York Times has stood up and corrected that 161-year-old story. So that's making me happy. More so is an essay from a site called Daily Dot. It was published just before the Oscars, I think on March 1st. And it's headlined, What the Jennifer Lawrence Backlash Tells Young Women. Mm. It's pushing back against a swell of negativity about Jennifer Lawrence that sort of rose in the days after she won the BAFTA award mm-hmm. over Lupita Nyong'o. Mm-hmm. And it's an argument about the impossible expectations we heap on women in the spotlight. And it dovetails very nicely with some of the very speedy pushback that emerged on Monday about all the Twitter buttheads who were so horrible about Kim Novak when she was on the Oscars. I like that increasingly there's a community of vocal writers, some of them women, but not by any means all of them,
right.
speaking up against that kind of behavior. It feels like it might be tipping a little bit about we're not going to put up with this kind of thing anymore.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Thank you, Trey Graham.
You're welcome.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Andy Daly is a comedian. He's great. That's it. No. he's shown up on Eastbound and Down, Enlisted, Modern Family, The League, Kroll Show, all over the place. And he's known, really, because he's been on Comedy Bang Bang, both the show and the podcast a lot, mm-hmm. as various characters. These characters start out relatively normal, and they start to spiral down very quickly into some deep, insanely dark places. Not to everybody's taste, but completely to mine. I commend to you his comedy album called Nine Sweaters, in which he gets up and does nine different characters who wear nine different sweaters. It's very funny. He has just recently started a new podcast, go figure, called Andy Daly's Podcast Pilot Project, in which many of these characters try out to have their own podcast, and things go spiral downward in very, very funny ways, as always. But the thing I want to say is that on March 6th, a show featuring him called Review will premiere on Comedy Central. The premise is that he's a guy who reviews his life experience. So, like, things like stealing and drug addiction and sleeping with a celebrity and going to prom and eating 15 pancakes. My first thought was, like, why would you tie this guy who is known for his characters, his bizarre characters, down to this one persona who is essentially kind of a straight man? But you find out very quickly into this first episode that he is great not because he does big characters. He does big characters because he's great. It's just, if you just watch this guy, you can't help but laugh. So Andy Daly, Review on Comedy Central.
Outstanding. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. One thing making me happy this week is that former digital arts intern here at NPR, Liz Mack, posted to Facebook yesterday that she had found a home after a year of looking for a multimedia project that she had worked on. It was a film that she had done. And she was saying, you know, as some of you know, I've really been looking around for the right place to get this published. And so finally I did, and I'm really excited, and it's gonna drop tomorrow. She's a devil in this way. She said, oh, by the way, it's at the New York Times. So Liz had her piece published in the New York Times. We will link to it. It's a video piece, and I was so excited for her. And she's one of those people I've owed an email to for like a year, of which there are which there are a couple. So we're very proud of her. But the other thing this week that is making me happy, it dovetails a little bit with what Trey was talking about with the Jennifer Lawrence stuff, and that is ABC premiered a very bad show last week called Mixology. And Mixology has a lot of really odious gender stereotypes. And I just thrilled to the number of really angry, really ringing reviews that just repeatedly called out this ridiculous stuff that was in this first couple of episodes. And I'm going to read you just a little tiny bit from Margaret Lyons at Vulture, who wrote a review of the show that was maybe even more stinging than mine. And mine was pretty stinging. She has just explained some of the horrible sexist things that have been said by this character named Bruce. If Bruce was set up as an object of ridicule on the show, that'd be one thing. But he's the bro we're all supposed to vaguely admire and in later episodes root for. In the coda for the pilot, he's scanning the bar for potential sex partners. There's a few girls here I can smash out, he says. Look at that chick over there throwing up. I'm going to bang her out. End credits. He also mentions in passing that a woman has a restraining order against him. I wish I could laugh at things like this, but I'm a woman and I'm alive. So instead of laughing at it, I actually have to spend my time avoiding being raped and worrying that if I ever were, the response would be, well, why'd you get so drunk? Perhaps Bruce could smash it out with someone able to give consent. Ha, ha, ha. So what I like about it, it's not the show that is making me happy by any means, especially since this is the show that has the slot that happy endings should have, which is terrible. What makes me happy about it is that, as Trey was kind of saying, when you do stuff like this, at least you will hear about it. And you will not hear about it from one person who feels alone, who feels like they are out there being the feminist. There is, as Trey was saying, a kind of tipping where at the very least you're going to have to listen to a lot of this. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a major theme. If you put a woman in a comedy pilot who says that she misses men who would smack women in the mouth, you're going to hear about that when people talk about your pilot. And you're going to hear about it consistently from a lot of people who will make each other feel a little bit less isolated in doing that. And that did make me really happy. And that brings us to the end of our show. Ta-da. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. You can follow our also producer, Lauren McGaughy, at L McGaughy. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to you all for being here a couple days after the Oscars.
Absolutely.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Look, there are a lot of NPR podcasts out there, and a lot of them are ones that we think you might enjoy. For word games and puzzles and trivia of all sorts, you should check out Ask Me Another. It's a rambunctious hour. It blends brain teasers with comedy and music. Do you like Jonathan Coulton? Who doesn't like Jonathan Coulton? He's on that show. Ophira Eisenberg on that show. Find Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts.